This morning, as we continue our discussion of the book of Revelation, we are finishing up with a few thoughts of Revelation chapter 13, verses 11 through 18. We have in our study been talking about the characters and symbols that are found in verses 11 through 18. We almost got finished with that in our study last week. I want to spend just a few moments talking about the mark the image of the beast. You'll notice beginning in verse 16 and going down through verse 18 of Revelation chapter 13 that he causes all, this is referencing the beast of the land, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, that no one may buy or sell except the one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of man, and his number is 666. We've discussed some aspects of this previously, especially last week, but we do want to, as we look at these things, again, just acknowledge a couple of points. And the first thing, when we talk about that mark, the purpose that a mark serves is to distinguish. That was the case in Revelation chapter 7 when you had some that had the seal of God that was placed upon their foreheads. It identified them as those who belonged to God. We're actually going to get an opportunity to revisit that thought in chapter 14 in just a little while because the first five verses deal with those individuals, the 144,000 that had the seal of God on their forehead. So you've got basically two marks that are found. The seal of God, which the 144,000 in Revelation chapter 7 had, and then those who have what is referred to as the mark of the beast that is upon their forehead or upon their right hand. And that mark is something that serves to identify those who are in his thrall, those who belong to him, the ones that are worldly in the Satan's, or in Satan's, or the dragon's realm, I guess we could say. And you'll notice that there were benefits that came as a result of having that mark. You'll notice it says that by having that mark on the right hand or their foreheads, they had that ability or were allowed to buy and sell, in contrast to those who did not have that mark. And so the purpose of a mark is to distinguish. In this case, the haves versus the have-nots in regard to the relationship that they had to the beasts of the sea and of the earth. And so we could also say, when we talk about that idea of a mark, as it always is the case, if you belong to someone, it is because you have given your allegiance to them. When we talk about the seal of God on the forehead of the 144,000, and like what the Calvinists would teach, that is God's choice and his alone, we understand that we have to give our allegiance to God, to be obedient to him, to be in that group among those who are sealed by God. And so it is a sign of loyalty. And we could say the same thing with regard to those who have the mark of the beast. They have given themselves over to the beast. In fact, if you read previously in the text, you talk about individuals who, verse 4, worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast. In verse in verse 12 of the text, that the beast of the land causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performed great signs to deceive them, and they worshiped him. They worshiped the beast from the sea because of the false prophet or the beast of the land's efforts to win them to that side. And so here is it's a sign of allegiance. So who do you give your allegiance to? Whose mark do you wear? Is a question that we need to be asking ourselves as well. I want you to notice a text in Daniel chapter 3. We're going to actually in our sermon this morning be talking quite a bit about chapters 2 through 6 of the book of Daniel. And it brought that to my mind in looking at this material. Because on that particular occasion, there was loyalty that was required of all the inhabitants of that Babylonian empire to Nebuchadnezzar. He had made a great image. And in verse 4, we are told, "A herald cried aloud, 'To you it's commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time that you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Now you remember on this particular occasion that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused, and as a result of that, they suffered the consequences. They were thrown into that great and fiery furnace. Now God spared them, but it was something that was a test of loyalty that Nebuchadnezzar gave to the people. And if you failed that test, you would be thrown into that fire. Now, whether or not there was a literal mark here or not, in other words, when we talk about that, we're talking about a tattoo that was put on them or anything. There's no evidence that we find secularly of this. It's no way that we can know exactly what that identifying mark was. But in this specific case, it was one that excluded the people of God, and as such served as a form of economic repression. There was something that had to identify them as being faithful to or submissive to whatever this great power was that is described with regard to the beast of the sea. So there was something that they were able to differentiate. Now in this case that we found in Daniel chapter 3, the way in which you knew who was loyal to Nebuchadnezzar and who was not is that when this music sounded, if you didn't drop to your knees and give homage to the beast, if you refused to do that, then that would be a sign that you were disloyal. And those who did, that would be an indication of loyalty to the king. But no commerce was allowed if you were not loyal to the empire and to the emperor. If again, as we have been taking that later date, it has reference to the Roman Empire. There are different kinds of persecution that come to men. In fact, I think that it could be said to a certain extent, that we as Christians today are persecuted for our faith. Certainly not to the extent that they were in the first century. But there are individuals who would seek to oppress our voice. There are criticisms that are laid against us as a result of our, and we don't fit in. We're not allowed to be a part of certain groups and situations and circumstances, primarily because we are Christians. It's becoming more and more that way in our society today. So there are different ways in which people can be oppressed or persecuted. Here, there is a reference less to the physical persecutions, the imprisonments and the deaths that came as a result of their faith, and here perhaps to economic privation or deprivation. And in this regard, it may not be that they could produce or be involved in commerce. It may have gone so far as to limit their employment opportunities. Those kinds of things are present. When we ask the question, however, what people say the mark is, there are literalists and futurists who say that the mark is something that is indeed a literal mark. The interesting thing about it, when they say the mark 666, typically they don't say that the number is literal. In other words, there is going to be a literal mark that is placed. The number 666 is a bit too overt for them in that regard, which shows an inconsistency in their hermeneutic. But as we've said before, that some have advocated that the mark has reference to the Social Security number. Back when the Social Security Administration was established, there were individuals who did not want to be a part of that, because that national identification number that was our Social Security number, that now again everyone has to get, was something that they considered to be the mark of the beast, and you wouldn't be able to participate. But you have individuals today saying the same thing about the vaccine cards. It's kind of an interesting thing. I listened to one of these premillennial preachers on YouTube who basically advocated for that. And the interesting thing is that as this Delta variant has reestablished the pandemic in certain places and caused individuals a pause. In New York, as an example, there is New York City. There has been a directive that has been given that individuals who do not prove that they have been vaccinated with a vaccine card cannot participate I know it was in going to gyms, and there was one other thing. Maybe in restaurants, I forget now exactly, but there are certain things that they were not able to do or would not be able to do, not go out for entertainment purposes unless they could show the establishment this vaccine card. And so some individuals would say that that's the kind of thing. I think that's way on out there in that regard. First of all, because the application here has to be in the first century. These were things that would shortly come to pass. And the problem with premillennialists typically are not only that they are inconsistent in their hermeneutic and that they are literalists sometimes when it suits them. That is, they want to look at the text in a literal fashion rather than accepting the symbolic nature of the apocalyptic language. But also, they take it out of context to refer to something that is yet future, even though the book of Revelation indicates that these things must shortly come to pass. So there are some problems with that. But that is what we mean when we regard to a mark. And we want to talk specifically about the mark, which is that number, in the number 666. But does anyone have anything they want to add before we get into the specific discussion? Yes.
I was just going to say, people like that. I don't know that you call it arrogant. Maybe just not considered, because they fit to the Social Security number and that. I think of this country only. This number, whatever it is for everybody, everything.
Yeah.
Not everybody has it.
That's exactly right. That's one of the. It's so myopic, I think, and so it's just short-sighted. Your focus is so narrow with regard to the application. Which some of you may be familiar with the name Herbert Armstrong. I believe that was his name. He was a leader of kind of a. He was a televangelist and leader of kind of a almost a cultic group. He died, I think, in the 70s or 80s. But he had written a book which basically established in his mind the reality of the United States of America as being a primary entity in biblical prophecy concerning the end days. There, of course, references, how Lindsay and others referred to the Soviet Union as being Gog and Magog. And references to an entity that actually doesn't exist anymore. There are efforts like that to try to, okay, we've got this present day a view that we are the final generation, which has absolutely no biblical merit whatsoever. But if we define it as it is today, then these things need to be true in order to fit into this literalist view of the Bible, and it's extremely myopic. It's the conceit of the present that is prevalent, and it's been that way for generations now. If you go back and you look at, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses back in the late 1800s, they were talking about the second coming of Christ and looking at these prophecies and making parallels with the present day back in the end of the 19th century. Events and nations and all those things, and trying to mold them in. And they did so in such a way as to rationalize that the end of the world was coming in 1898. And then it was, I think, 1914 after that. And they tried a couple of more times in the mid-20th century before they stopped making such predictions. But there are individuals who do those same kinds of things. I've told you this before, but one of the books in my library is from Hal Lindsey. And he had The Late Great Planet Earth, where he was talking about these end times. But he has a title of a second book that he wrote that wasn't quite as popular. It's called Countdown to Armageddon, the 1980s. And I remember reading it in the 1980s. I bought that book, and I want to see what he has to say. And I don't know if I bought it. I think if it did, it was at the secondhand store. But I got the book, and I read through it. And his position was that all the signs with regard to the Soviet Union and the Cold War and America and all of these kinds of things, putting them in there, that the world was going to have this great battle, and it would happen by the end of the decade. Countdown to Armageddon, 1980s. And of course, that came and went. Hal Lindsey is still followed, and many people believe what he has to say, but he's wrong. And everyone's wrong who have such that... again, I think there's another... area where this phrase is used, another application, but the conceit of the present, that idea that we're the ones. is something that's very prevalent in just about every generation and rises to problems. Talking about that idea, let's go ahead and slide into the idea of the number of the beast, which is 666, because this gives us a good example of it. We talked about the Social Security numbers and such. Again, it's typical of the literalists and their view as they strive to establish the significance of the number 666 to do something that we're incapable of doing. Now, Dennis made a good point about that in our discussion a week or two ago, in pointing out that this number would have had some significance and they would be aware of what it was and what it meant there at that time that these things were happening, this mark, this number, to where they could distinguish between those who are righteous and those who are not. But one of the things that is prevalent today is that speculation as to what the number 666 alludes to, because they want to find who this Antichrist is and who will wear the mark and who will be ultimately that one who is battling against God in those end times. And I'll just give you one example of what has been done. Emperor Nero is believed by some to be the individual who's the number of the mark of the beast, the number of the beast refers to. And when Nero Caesar, and I don't remember if it's Nero Caesar or just Nero, the name is transcribed, it somehow comes out to the number 666. What they do is they transliterate Greek form of the name Nero Caesar into the Hebrew, and then from that they derive that number 666. Now I want you to think about this, because what they're basically doing is using a Hebrew transliteration of the Greek form of a Latin name to get to the number 666 to fit. This is the kind of grasping that is very prevalent and very much present among those who seek to take things like this in literal fashion and try to speculate as to what those things could mean. And then when they come upon it, it's like, oh, look, I have had revealed to me, or I have come across something nobody else knows, and they become these proselytizers of their particular vision and idea. And that's very, very dangerous. It leads an awful lot of individuals astray. But there are other names that have been given throughout history that can derive from playing around with numbers. Hitler is one, Napoleon, Mussolini, Saddam Hussein, as well as John F. Kennedy, which I alluded to in a previous lesson. And you can play around with names and figure ways in order to make equivocations and such. Do you remember the, it was something that was very popular in about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, to where someone had uncovered this code in the Bible. I can't remember if it was something that was taken directly from the English translations or if it goes back to the original language, but that there was some kind of an encoded message in Scripture, and that they had derived what that is, and that was used as proof that the New Testament Scriptures were inspired of God. So, what do we argue with regard to the inspiration of Scripture? We argue that the Scripture calls itself inspired, 2 Timothy chapter 3, 16 and 17. So it makes the claim of inspiration. And then we find that it was established as inspired by the signs and the wonders that were done by Christ first, and then those who followed after him and those who wrote the books of the Bible. So there was this establishing of the veracity of the claims that were made, and that's all that we need. Now, someone comes along and says, here's real proof, and it's, again, some arbitrary assignation of these different formulas to lead to this code that's within the book. And that was the proof that they offered. And no one knew it until the 1990s when this person comes up with it. Those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. There are dangers come with the attempts to literalize these kinds of things. We've striven to have a consistent hermeneutic in approaching the book of Revelation, approaching the numbers as symbolic numbers. Now, I do want you to notice in the word 666 and verse 18 of the text that it is stated what the number 6 is, the number, or 666 is. It's the number of a man. So that's the name, or that's the definition that is ascribed to this particular number, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Yes, Dennis?
Just a quick thought on the idea of fasting. Common faith teaches that fasting is not necessarily for health reasons. Commentators, those who go to great lengths to write swelling books, to comment verse by verse on the whole Bible, they want to come up with an explanation. It's very rare for a man to publish in print the words, "I do not know what this means."
Yeah.
Now, I have read men that have actually said that,
yeah,
but most of them will grasp at some kind of explanation.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's best just to say, "I don't know."
Yeah.
And leave it at that. Here's something just considered, occurred to me that it never has before. And I'm saying with a big capital I and F, if that's what the Hebrews did, the Jewish Hebrews in the first century, whether early or late they, if that's what they did, that's what they had to do. Hebrew didn't have a Hebrew name. If they used Hebrew numerology to compute the name of any Latin name, they would have had to have converted to Hebrew and then come up with the number.
Yep.
So who are we to say that that's not what they did? We just don't know.
Don't know.
So when we accuse someone of, you know, of coming up with an explanation like that, they grasp it, they say, okay, they're not. They're just offering an explanation like anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, but my objection would be more that when we find numbers that are found within visions and such, where we take things as being symbols and have symbolic meanings that are attributed and defined in other places of the text, and then we try to make that liberal, that's an inconsistent hermeneutic. And you see, and we'll see this in the next section when we talk about the 144,000 again in just a few moments. Because that's a number that is taken by, for example, by the Jehovah's Witnesses as a literal number. But then if you take that as a literal number, then there are other aspects of the description that's given there that have to be taken literally as well. And that would be primarily that every one of the 144,000 that is listed in that are virgins. 144,000 virgins is being in the text, because that's how they're described in that particular text. So I'm saying that to say this. The Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that everyone in the group of 144,000, some of them even attribute themselves as part of that group, of that set number that will be in heaven instead of the paradise on earth in their theology. They don't claim that all 144,000 of those individuals are virgins. But that's what the text says, if it's to be taken literally. So the inconsistency in that, I think, would be taking some things literally and some things not literally. And that's something that that is difficult, because what we've discussed throughout our discussion up to this point, through the 13 chapters, we've given these numbers, the different numbers that are given. It's the number of the divine and what the number 12 reference is. And when we get, for example, into the 20th chapter and we have reference to the 1,000-year reign of Christ, is that a literal 1,000 years? And that's problematic, because Christ reign is already established, and that reign has taken place over a 2,000-year period of time rather than 1,000 years. But individuals will take that literally and ascribe to it a meaning that is yet future. So those are the kinds of things we're talking about. And again, we don't know what the mark is. I understand that is the case. It's something that there was a means of identifying on the part of the people of God, and on the part of the secular powers, who was and who was not loyal to them. That much is obvious from the text. But what that specifically was is difficult for us to ascertain, though it may have been familiar to them, or would have been familiar to them. Yes, Rick?
I just got to mention that while the book does talk about things that must shortly take place, there are things that are discussed in this book that have not taken place, and that's judgment.
Yeah.
So there are some future aspects to this. We just have to keep that in balance.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, but as you look at the structure of the book, it's something that becomes obvious as to what those yet future events are. Okay, then let us continue on. And I just want to note one other thing about the number itself, number 666. It is described in the latter part of that verse. Yes, the number of a man, verse 18. And looking at the number 6, looking at the number 7, we have talked about that with regard to what the number 7 is. It was denoted as a number of perfection by the Jews. It was used often. We made reference to the seven spirits of God, which has a reference or is a description of the Holy Spirit that is given in Revelation chapter 4 and other places here in the book of Revelation and other places. So the seven spirits of God, that is divine. Seven number is the number of the divine or the number of perfection. When I say the number of the divine, it is a number that is attributed to divinity, to God, on a number of occasions. He says 6 is the number of a man. It's common sense that if you have the number 7, which represents God, then the number of a man would be less than 7. If perfection is indicated by the number 7, then imperfection would be the number 6. So I would remind you of two verses that are found in the 13th chapter. First of all, verse 10, which is evident and obvious. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. This is referencing the beast from the sea and his ultimate failure. He would oppress. He would exercise the power of the sword. This is one of the reasons we attributed this to the physical power that existed at that time. But he would eventually fall. He would eventually be defeated by the sword, which, again, if you look at the Roman Empire as well as other empires, that happened. It is something that is evident. We'll be talking about Belshazzar and the fact being the last king of Babylon in our lesson today, and how that the empire of Babylon was overtaken and Darius the Mede became the king of the empire. And, of course, it became a Medo-Persian empire rather than the Babylonian Empire, because the Babylonian Empire was overthrown. This is what happens to these secular powers. They are overthrown. So the significance of this is found in the latter part of verse 10. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. So this is the message. Yes, the oppression is real. Yes, this is a difficult time. But this power that seems supreme, this power is going to be overtaken. Because you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And that's what we remember. That's what we have as a message of hope. It's the patience and the faith of the saints. Then in verse 18, I just want you to see the parallels that are found here, because I think this is an acceptable explanation, or as good as any explanation of the intent from verse 18. You'll notice in verse 10, the last sentence is, here is the patience and faith of the saints. In verse 18, the first sentence is, here is wisdom. Okay? Here is wisdom. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. Here is wisdom is an indication that this is something that the vision is intended to supply to us. This is something that you want to know. What was something that they wanted, that he wanted them to know in chapter 13, verses 1 through 10? This great power was going to fall. So if you parallel the structure of verse 10 with verse 18, here is wisdom, you see the same message being established. Here is wisdom. This is, we've been describing these beasts from the land, this horrible beast that has these powers that can cause the world to worship the first beast, that will cause the mark to be placed upon men with regard to the buying and selling. But understand this. Let him who understands or has understanding calculate the number of the beast. It is the number of man. And the point that can be made with regard to that is that when man comes up against God, just as 6 is less than 7, when man who is less than God comes up against God, ultimately, the victory is gone. Now, I think both these passages can be used to describe the inevitability of the defeat of these beasts, though they are very powerful and very oppressive. All right, so that would be the view that I would share with you with regard to the number 666 and the number of amen. Anybody have any comments, questions before we go on beyond this? And we just got a couple of summary statements to make before we get into the next study. Anybody else? All right, then, let us go just to the next slide very quickly, which is, again, extra notes typically that we may not have covered, but we really covered everything. So these are simply a few summary statements, because we spent almost a month, or we have spent a month discussing this particular chapter, actually this particular aspect of the chapter 11 through 18. Number one, the two minions of Satan, the oppressive empire and the false religion, are both very effective and both have a part that they play in the oppression of God's people, the persecution of God's people. False religion was effective in convincing the world to worship the empire. We talked a great deal about that, indicating that it takes discernment, that there is a distinction that we can see and that they could see in the first century between the legitimate power of God and what these individuals were offering. But it is something that is extremely effective in leading individuals astray. We can make that application today that false religion does it here as well in our time. Those without the beast mark would be oppressed and persecuted, but wisdom would note the imperfect and ultimately unsuccessful beast. And, of course, we alluded to the 19th chapter where we are told that the beast of the land, beast of the sea, and the false prophet, which is another name for the beast of the earth, that these two were cast into the lake of fire and for eternity. So we do see the eventual overcoming of them as related in Revelation 19, and then the dragon himself in Revelation 20. All right, questions, comments before we get into new material? All right, then let us go to chapter 14. This is the 12th scene in our material, and just consists of five verses. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. And as we look at this particular text, there are a couple of things I want you to be aware of. I like the way Justin put it with regard to the 80th Psalm. Before we read it, I want to analyze it just a little bit and give you kind of a setting so that you can understand it correctly. And that is a good thing to do from time to time. So just first thing I want you to note as we read through this is the difference in the tone and the subject material. We go from the evil, we go to the good. Previous two chapters were a terrifying description of the enemies of the cross of Christ, the dragon and the two beasts, dragon in chapter 12, the two beasts in chapter 13, and the very real physical and spiritual dangers that were present among the redeemed. This was a difficult time for God's people that they were living through. And so while the descriptions were given, and we might state that there is an acknowledgement that yes, it is tough right now, and this is what's happening right now, and this is what's going on, and these powers are great, it would be good, after having done that, to take just a few moments to give some encouragement. And I think this short scene in chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, establishes a picture of optimism and ultimately victory for the people of God. And it's a very timely a passage. It is very appropriate after this description that is given that might be discouraging as you consider the powers of the dragon and these two beasts. To make note of what is happening, what is going to happen. Notice chapter 14, verses 1. excuse me, verses 1 through 5 of the text. Chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. And I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps, and they sang a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. So, what we want to do, as always when we look at these things, is give some introductory thoughts, impressions that we might have concerning what we have just read. So, does anyone want to share with me any perceptions, any emotions, any feelings that they derive from this reading? Yes, Aaron.
It reminds me, it's hope in the midst of desperation. It reminds me of
reminds me a lot of Elijah fleeing Jezebel after the Mount Carmel thing, right? Where he flees to a cave and he's talking about, I'm the only one left, just kill me now, let's end it. And God says, no, there's a lot left that not bound fails, and you're going to go back and you're going to still be that man of God you need to be. And he gives him a glimpse of the future, and I think that's exactly what he's saying.
Good, very good. Anybody else? No? Okay. Well, then let me just share with you my thoughts and in this regard. And the first thing I want to make note of is an acknowledgement of the similarities that are found in this particular text and the seventh chapter, specifically with regard to the 144,000. We have characters here that we've already introduced that we're familiar with. We're not going to spend as much time in identifying the symbols and characters in this particular section as we have in times past because of that. We have the Lamb. Who is the Lamb? Jesus, the Christ, is referred to as the Lamb. There are a number of passages where there is an allusion to this. Remember in chapter 5 in the throne room scene after God is identified, and there is the sorrow that that John has that no one was worthy to open that sealed book, that then the Lamb at the right hand of the Father in heaven opened the seals, or was able or had that ability to open the seals. It has reference to the Christ. In chapter 7, where we find the identification in the first few verses of that text of the 144,000, we find after that there is a great multitude in heaven that is distinguished from the 144,000 who were on the earth. And in heaven, the Lamb was found in the presence, or the presence, the multitude were found in the presence of the Lamb, as recorded there. Chapter 12, verse 11, there is a reference to the blood of the Lamb, which was the means by which the victory would come for those who are His. And in chapter 13 and verse 8, we are told that the contrast given, that those who were not a part of the beast's realm, it says that that they were the ones that had their hands or their names written in the book of life, or the book of life of the Lamb who was slain from the foundation of the world. So we have a familiarity with the Lamb. Here we find the Lamb, and you'll note here he is standing on Mount Zion. Now we'll identify what Mount Zion is in just a few moments. The second group that are found here, or the second figures that are mentioned, the 144,000. Now, when you look at the 144,000, there are two significant statements that are made about them. First, the number, 144,000. Secondly, that they had the seal of God on their foreheads that parallel exactly what is found in chapter 7 in verses 4 and 8. In chapter 7 in verses 4 and 8, the 144,000 are on earth. We define them and indicated that these are the elect of God that are upon earth at that time. They were the ones that would be suffering and going through this difficult time. Here they are identified as being on Mount Zion, which again, if you'll note what Mount Zion refers to in this particular text, it refers to heaven rather than and on earth. And that happens a number of times in Scripture that we'll allude to a little bit later. So they are with the four living creatures, they are with the 24 elders on Mount Zion singing this song of victory. So what Aaron identified as being so is a glimpse of what's going to be. Because he's identified them, the elect of God that are suffering the oppression here, as being the 144,000. And so now you have a future reference to them being in heaven with God and singing a new song. So there very much is the idea of a glimpse at the victory, a glimpse at the comfort and the joy that would be present in the future that is found in this particular text. And so, when we come to the emotions and the perceptions that we have, if you think about that, what could be discouraging as you look at chapters 12 and 13, this particular thing is something that would give great encouragement to them. The encouragement as they recognize that the reward for the righteous life is to be in the presence of Christ, in the presence of the Lamb, and singing that new song. You remember the Apostle Paul's statement in Philippians chapter 1, when he talked about the fact that he was in a strait betwixt two, because he said it would be more needful for you if I remained here, because then I could help you and I could assist you and I could teach you. But he said to depart and be with Christ is far better. It's a better thing to be in heaven than it is to be on earth. And so this would be something that would truly be an encouragement to them as they anticipated that joy of heaven that is described in that particular text. One other passage about that is Psalm 62, 2 and 3. Psalm 68, 2 and 3, which states, "Let the wicked perish at the presence of God, but let the righteous be glad. Let them rejoice before God. Yes, let them rejoice exceedingly." So I thought that was a beautiful passage describing certainly the end joy that we will receive in a life that is well lived. The third thing to note in verse 4 and 5 of the text, the characteristics that are given to those who are sealed by God. There are specific things that are mentioned. The first is they're not defiled with women. Secondly, that they are followers of the Lamb wherever He goes. You remember, there are actually parables and there are actually statements given by men who said, "Lord, I'll follow you wherever you go." And He said, "Wait a second. You know, I don't have anywhere to lay my head." But that's the idea. These are individuals who actually bought into that idea. No matter where the Lord takes you, you're going to go. And then thirdly, there was no deceit or guile, that they were without fault before God. Now, we'll talk about those characteristics a little bit later in more detail. But if we wanted to give a simple statement concerning the nature of the characteristics, these are referring to people who are righteous and pure. That's a description that is given. Virginity is always alluded to as being a sign of righteousness, being without deceit or guile, not being a liar but being honest. Also, the idea of submission and obedience to the Christ to do His will, allegiance, loyalty, all of these are signs of righteousness and holiness. And so that describes the individuals who are the 144,000. That gives us pause because, it's a very oblique way of doing it, but it is something that is characteristic of the narrative that we find throughout the entirety of the New Testament. Sometimes it's overtly stated. Sometimes it's implicit in this concept of relationships or description. You're not going to be among the elect of God unless you're holy, unless you're righteous. Calvinistic view to where once saved, always saved, that individuals... actions, how he conducts his life, has no bearing upon his eternal standing with God, is just not valid. When the description is given of the elect of God, these are individuals who are without fault before God. Doesn't mean that they're sinless or that they've never sinned. It means that they are the redeemed. Their sins have been forgiven. They have that relationship, that reconciliation with God. They are righteous people. And that requires that you live righteously. And the descriptions that are given of these individuals are just that. Okay, so keep that in mind. Perhaps have in mind the text of 1 Peter 1, verses 15 and 16. "As he who has called you is holy, you also be holy in all of your conduct. Because it's written, 'Be holy, for I am holy.'" And that is the call for the people of God. So that's what I wanted to share with you with regard to that first idea of the initial impressions. Anybody want to add anything to that? Okay. The second one we'll be able to get through very quickly because sometimes, as we have alluded to, these things are somewhat repetitive, and that certainly would be the case with such a short passage of Scripture. So the purpose of the seeing, what God intends for us to learn, is number one, that it is a scene that describes an encouraging situation or circumstance to those who are suffering. So we learn, and they learn, that ultimately, that despite the difficulties of life, there is joy to be found in heaven, and that if they strive to be faithful in the end, that's where they will be. And secondly, the type of individuals that they needed to be in order to be like that. Those who are a part of that group are those who are righteous. And so that's, I think, the intention of this, primarily, as Aaron indicated, to give comfort to them. Was that the second bell? Okay, sorry about that. All right, so we will pick up then with a couple of practical applications that can be made both to them or that they could make, and then, of course, we as well, which again is I think, very similar in this text. And then we'll get into the symbols and characters. So this is going to be a pretty quick study. I really feel like there's a good chance that we'll finish with this next week, just this short verse, and get into verses 6 and following. All right, appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.